This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Terminus, written by Peter Klines, performed by Ray Porter. 1. Murdoch still wasn't sure how he felt about this new congregation, even though he'd had a lot of sex with the minister when they were both younger. He leaned against one of the big rocks and looked at the minister across the moonlit beach. She talked with a few of the folks up at the front of the crowd, clasped her hands, and laughed at something one of them said to her. The nighttime surf caught their words and dragged them out to sea with a faint hiss. She still wore her hair long, letting it hang in a straight, dark sheet down the back of her robe. A robe that couldn't hide the fact she'd stayed slim and toned. She looked good enough to make him think fondly of the old days, back when they'd been teens, when he could still pass for human, and she was just Anne, not the minister. As Murdoch watched, she detached herself from her latest bit of small talk and moved to stand in front of the congregation, the ocean behind her. They quieted down and focused. Almost 300 members altogether. Some had brought beach chairs, while others lounged on blankets. A few at the back, like him, stood or slumped against one of the beach's big stones.
"This is probably a bad way to start this,"
and the minister said, just loud enough to be heard over the surf.
"But to be honest, I lost my faith years ago."
An awkward chuckle worked its way through the crowd. Murdoch smiled with them.
"I was a typical kid,"
she explained as she strolled back and forth across the sand.
"Thought I knew everything. Thought my parents were idiots."
Like every typical kid, she'd found someone to hang out with her parents wouldn't like. Murdoch had been her friend in grade school, then her boyfriend in junior high, and then, in the awkward, fumbling way of over-enthusiastic teens trying to get it right, they'd become lovers. It had been one of the happiest points in Murdoch's life.
"The one thing I knew for sure, though," continued Anne, "that I knew for a fact, was that the great ones weren't real."
This time an uneasy murmur crept through the congregation. The Todwings prided themselves on being more progressive than many of the various sects, notably the one Murdoch had grown up in. They'd accepted a female minister, after all. But the casual joke about the great ones still made their skin crawl. Their discomfort was clear, even in the dark.
"I'd lost my faith," Anne repeated. "Truth be told, maybe I never had any faith at all. I went to Sunday school, listened to the sermons, but I didn't believe."
She stopped pacing for a moment to look out at the midnight ocean.
"I ran away,"
she confessed, turning back to the congregation.
"Left my parents, my brother, my boyfriend."
In the dark, her eyes flitted up and met his, just for an instant. A quick smile graced her thin lips. So she did know he was here. The ugly truth was he'd done the abandoning. She'd left the family, yes, but they'd made secret plans for months to run off together, get married in Vegas, maybe settle down somewhere on the East Coast, as far from the family as possible. Then the change had come. Later than most for both of them. It brushed across Anne, enhancing her eyes and hair and skin, turning her from a skinny girl to a lustrous woman. Murdoch, though? It had hit him hard. Hard enough to make him question their plans and his lack of faith. And begged him to leave with her anyway, but years of family conditioning had its teeth back in him. No amount of pleading or young love or enthusiastic sex could convince him to leave. Not looking like he did. Not with what it implied.
I cut all ties and wandered off, said the minister. I supported myself as best I could. I tried acting like everyone in Los Angeles, ended up waiting tables, got a temp job doing data entry at a magazine that stretched on for almost a year.
She stuck her hands deep into the pockets of the robe and swept its hem back and forth across the sand.
And then, one day, my brother called. He said he had proof that he'd done it. He said he'd found the damned machine.
Another ripple across the crowd, partly for the curse, partly for what she'd attached it to. Murdoch echoed this one. Even when they were all kids, Andrew had been kind of a sanctimonious prick. He'd only gotten worse as they got older.
I think we all remember that night, Anne told the congregation, and how it turned out for the Olmsted side of the family.
A rumble of acknowledgement and approval. Murdoch echoed this one, too. It had been dumb luck he hadn't been rounded up with the surviving members of his congregation. He'd been on an errand up in Oakland, collecting a lost heirloom with the standard double-blind rental truck. Nothing in the vehicle tying it or him to the family. Nothing with the family tying them to him or the truck. He'd taken his time driving home from Oakland, though, reconsidering the idea of running away. The thought of it had never completely left him, and over the years Anne had been gone, it had grown strong again. Sunglasses could hide his eyes. If he kept his hands in his pockets, out of sight, no one would ever suspect a thing. He could do it. He could run away and live somewhere else. Then he'd made it home to see family members in handcuffs being loaded into black vans, and the idea had withered again. He drove by without slowing, without more than a casual, curious glance, got back on the freeway and headed back up to the Bay Area to hide for a month.
I was supposed to be with them, said Anne. I was supposed to be there, but I didn't believe. So my brother found his destiny, one way or another, and I...
She looked out at the congregation and gave a big, theatrical shrug.
I moved to San Diego and got a job as a receptionist.
They all laughed. Murdoch chuckled at the thought of his wild high school girlfriend sitting at a front desk and answering phones.
I'd been doing that for almost 2 years when it happened. There was an emergency in one of the buildings in the complex I worked at. I pitched in, was helping with some malfunctioning equipment, and then suddenly, right in front of me, one of the holy vanguards appeared.
Murmurs and gasps rolled through the crowd like breakers across the sand.
A seraph, not 5 feet from me. He fixed his eyes on me, judged me, spoke to me in the old tongue. Asked me if this world was ready for the great ones. I told him it was ready, swollen with its ripeness.
She paused and gave the congregation a quick, shy smile.
At least I think I did. Like I said before, I wasn't the best Sunday school student, and I hadn't uttered a word of the old tongue in years at that point.
Another nervous chuckle from the crowd. Embarrassed, they were giggling at something they knew should be heresy. It amazed Murdoch how well she played them.
It went to speak to me again, she continued, and the humans killed it. They gunned the Holy One down right in front of me. I heard it breathe its last. Watched it die.
Gasps of horror now. A few sobs that mixed with the gurgle of the incoming tide. A man off to Murdoch's left balled his hands into fists and muttered an angry prayer.
I was in shock for the better part of a day, Anne told them. But when I could think straight again, I realized how wrong I'd been. About everything. And that's why I'm here, talking to you. It's why I rejoined the family. It's why I'm so glad You've accepted me after Father Jacob's death. May he rest with the great ones.
The Todwing congregation echoed the phrase back to her, all smiles again. Murdoch muttered the empty words and stared down at his bare feet. He flexed his toes in the sand.
But you need to understand something. I never found my faith again.
Anne let the murmur build, then raised her voice to speak over it before it had a chance to die down.
I don't speak to you from a position of faith, but from one of knowledge. I'm talking to you about inarguable facts as I've experienced them. The seraphs are real. The great ones are real. Our mission is real. We will end the tyranny of the machine. We will open the door for the great ones, and we will save this world from itself.
She'd stretched her arms out, her fingers spread wide, as if she was funneling her message to the crowd. They applauded. They loved her. Murdoch watched from the back as the congregation lumbered forward, all wet cheeks and outstretched arms. Anne grabbed hands, accepted hugs, exchanged agreeable words and nods. She bent to greet some of the elders who'd been wheeled to her at the water's edge but couldn't rise from their chairs. And once, during a free moment, her eyes flitted back and found him against the rocks. He couldn't read her eyes at all. 2. As someone who'd spent most of his life in the city, surrounded by office buildings and apartment high-rises, Chase kept being surprised by how hypnotic he found the huge expanse of nothing, especially at sunset. He settled against the Makara's railing, felt the wind and spray pepper his face, and just looked out at the rolling ocean. The water stretched to the horizon in every direction he could see. Always the same, always different. Endless possibilities and a huge lack of options at the same time. Or maybe he was projecting just a bit. He'd been traveling with no destination for almost a year now. 11 months, 2 weeks, and a day. The Makara was the 8th cargo ship he'd booked passage on in that time. Not the nicest captain or crew, but far from the worst. A lot of times, traveling on these ships almost felt like staying in a small floating hotel. Good rooms, good food, rec rooms, gyms, nightly movies. A few of them even had shops. The Makara felt more like a floating bed and breakfast, or like an old-fashioned boarding house. The crew was polite and offered conversation over meals, but for the most part, they just left him alone. If not for the other passenger, there would have been 3 or 4 days when he never spoke to anybody.
Hey, Chesa.
He looked up from the railing and saw the first mate, a man with the too-good-to-be-true name of Katanga, strolling across the deck toward him. Over the past 2 weeks, he'd gotten the sense the first mate also doubled as a sort of hospitality director. They'd had 4 or 5 pleasant bouts of small talk over dinner and breakfast.
Just Chase, he reminded the first officer.
He stepped to the side, making space for the other man on the vast open railing. Katanga had jet black skin and a rolling accent that touched on Scottish with an occasional Brooklyn twang. He set his hands on the railing and smiled out to sea.
A man like you needs a more dynamic name. Chase is a boy's name. Spoiled rich kids.
It's my name.
Change it. I did.
Yeah?
Yes.
A wave crashed up against the side of the Makara. The boat didn't even shudder. It plowed on through the sea, heading for the sunset.
So, said Katanga, who's waiting for you in Johannesburg?
Nobody.
A business trip?
Chase shook his head.
Still in the wild?
Sort of.
Katanga rubbed his chin.
I see. So it's a great journey of self-discovery, then.
What?
Travel from ship to ship. No real destination, mull over your life, wonder about the decisions you made, figure out where you're going with your life.
Captain told you my sob story, huh?
Katanga made a rude noise and shook his head.
He doesn't tell me anything.
Christ, am I that much of a stereotype? The first mate shrugged.
Believe it or not, there aren't many types of people who pick us over a carnival cruise.
Chase laughed. Makes sense.
So?
So what?
Are you going to tell me your sub story?
Seriously?
Yes.
Why?
Because I forgot to sync my Kindle before we left port. I finished my last new book 3 days ago.
So you want my life as entertainment?
Katanga shrugged. I need my stories.
Chase turned and stared back out at the waves.
About 2 years ago, a hurricane hit my hometown, Houston. I lost everything.
Katanga clucked his tongue.
Everything?
Everything.
Chase took a slow breath and arranged the story elements in his mind. He'd told the big lie a few times now, enough that he'd gotten very good at it. He'd learned which parts of the truth to tell, which to leave out, and which ones to gloss over.
I've got an engineering degree, but I couldn't get a job anywhere big. Ended up opening my own shop. I'd repair electronics or buy stuff and refurbish it.
Good money?
Good enough. Mostly, I'd fix televisions for people. Sometimes entertainment systems in cars. People think electronics are all super complex these days, that it's easier to throw them out than repair them. A lot of the time, though, it's just a bunch of simple systems working side by side, like picture in picture. It isn't some high-tech thing. It just means your television's got two tuners, one for one image, one for the other.
So, you lost your business.
Chase wrapped his knuckles on the railing. The big lie always started with a lot of boring truth. It put the listeners in a certain mood.
I gambled on the hurricane. Everyone saw it coming, but I figured lots of storm damage meant lots of business for me. Sank a lot of money into parts and supplies. Had it express shipped so I'd get it before the storm.
Even made an awful television commercial that ran on the Houston channels for 3 days before the storm. Emptied our savings and maxed out the cards. Pissed off my ex-wife.
Ex then or ex now?
Now. But we were already on the way out then. I thought a nice solid payday might let us ignore some things, stretch it out a while longer. Worst case scenario, our marriage falls apart anyway and I sock some extra money away for our daughter, Dina. Start a college fund or something.
Katanga gripped the railing and leaned back, stretching his back and legs.
That what happened?
No. The hurricane hit hard. Caused more flooding than anyone expected. A lot more. Wiped out my shop and my inventory. And the house we were renting.
Your family?
Elizabeth wasn't happy. There was some insurance money, but by the time we got it in our hands, we'd racked up more debt just trying to stay alive. A few months after the storm, she ended up going to stay with her mom in Dallas. A lawyer showed up with divorce papers about 2 weeks later.
Damn. That's cold, man.
Like I said, the writing was already on the wall. It burned, but I couldn't say I was surprised.
He took his hands off the rail and shrugged.
I got a crappy apartment and a job installing cable for Spectrum.
She took your daughter, too?
Yeah,
said Chase.
Yeah, she did.
He turned from the sea to meet Katanga's gaze. Unlike the Makara's other passenger who came back to the topic every 3 or 4 days, the first mate understood this part of the story was over. Katanga turned around to lean against the railing and inspect a stack of shipping containers.
How did you end up here, then?
Chase shrugged.
I just did it once, at first. Houston to Belgium. Just wanted to do something to feel alive. I'd gone through almost a year of getting beaten down by everything. I just wanted to get away from everything, do something impulsive, but I liked it.
So you did another trip.
It's all I've been doing. The Makar is my eighth, counting that first one.
What about home?
I read this article a couple years ago about old people who were living on cruise ships instead of going into nursing homes. Better conditions, helpful staff, lots to do, even better medical care if they needed it. Katanga nodded.
Had this story before.
Yeah, apparently it's true. So, I had that in my head. I'd been back from my first trip for about 2 days, and I was reading a Lee Child book.
Love the Jack Reacher stories,
said Katanga with a grin.
I don't think I've read any of them in order, but I love them all.
Did you read the new one?
I don't know. The last one I read started with the woman on the train who shoots herself.
I remember that one, Chase said with a nod. Anyway, I opened the book and hit one of those sections where Reacher is explaining his whole lifestyle, how he just travels around and doesn't own anything except the clothes on his back. He was even breaking it down, showing this woman how much cheaper it was to just buy new clothes every 3 or 4 days rather than have a house with utility bills to hold the clothes and a washer and dryer. Katanga grinned. And right there, it just all made sense. It was cheaper to travel than to stay in the crappy apartment, so I sold about 95% of what I had left after the storm and the divorce and shoved the rest in a storage locker the size of a closet, canceled the lease on the apartment, and got on a ship.
Just like that.
3 weeks, 21 days from decision to boarding. That was a year ago. Since then, I've been enjoying the peace and figuring out how I'm supposed to move on. Like you said, big spiritual self-discovery trip.
Got to tell you,
Katanga said,
that's all pretty pathetic. You, my friend, are a textbook case of doing everything wrong.
Tell me about it.
No, seriously.
Thanks.
Don't take it as an insult. You won't find anyone on this ship who did everything right, believe me. But sometimes, the wrong path can still take you to the right place.
That's deep.
Thank you, I just made it up.
So what's your deal?
How do you mean?
You always want to be a sailor? Sail the oceans, all that?
Katanga shook his head.
Only thing I know how to do. Only thing I've ever done.
How'd you get into it?
The first mate held one hand out over the rails. He used his thumb to crack his knuckles one at a time.
Are you one of those Americans who freaks out over things?
I just told you I lived through a hurricane.
Yes, but you're American. You people freak out over all sorts of stupid little things.
I think I'm pretty calm.
Katanga nodded.
I was a pirate.
What?
A pirate out of Somalia for about 3 years.
Did you ever kill anyone?
The first mate shrugged.
Nah. I fired my rifle up in the air once or twice, but that's it.
Chase nodded once while he considered the words. He kept his eyes out on the ocean.
How'd you end up here?
The government cracked down. Many of my friends and family went back to being fishermen. I went to Kenya, got a job on a boat. That was almost 12 years ago.
So I guess you're on a big journey of self-discovery, too.
Katanga smiled and blew some air loudly out of his nose.
I discovered myself years ago. That's when I became Katanga.
He slapped his chest twice with his palm.
This is who I am now. And it matters just as much as who I was then.
If you say so.
I do. I also say there's a monster of a storm coming up behind us. Captain Hagen might be ordering everyone to stay off deck tonight and tomorrow, so keep an ear out.
3. Murdoch stood in the hall and stared at the door. He always felt a bit uneasy in nice apartment buildings. Out of place tended to be his default setting whenever he went out in public, but the dial turned even more to the right when he found himself someplace where rent was distinctly higher than he could afford. He glanced up and down the hall for a third time, took a breath, tried to shake his shoulders loose. He couldn't be sure if it felt more like he was heading toward a first kiss or a firing squad. His heartbeat wasn't helping him figure it out. He raised his hand and knocked on the door a lot harder than he meant to. The sound echoed in the hall. He looked around again, waiting for angry neighbors to appear. Footsteps padded behind the door. A chain rattled. A deadbolt turned. Anne swung the door open. Her hair was up in a loose bun, and she wore dark tights with an oversized shirt, still looking like some kind of model, he thought, even when she was being casual.
"Murdoch,"
she said.
"Come on in."
She stepped back and waved him inside. He followed her, closed the door behind himself, wondered if he should reset the locks.
"Do me a favor and kick your shoes off," she called back over her shoulder. "White carpets."
He slid his sunglasses off and stared after her, looked at the small mat by the door, covered with a jumble of shoes, all small, all hers. No other footprints in the plush white carpet. He pried his shoes off by the heels and towed them onto the mat. The carpet was as soft as it looked. He relaxed a tiny bit more. Anne's apartment felt a little barren for its size. Big rooms with just one or two items of furniture. The stark white walls and carpet didn't help. He looked across a small breakfast bar into the kitchen and saw empty counters. As he watched, she pulled open a cabinet to show four glasses sitting in the middle of three empty shelves.
"Do you want some water or anything?"
He shook his head. The cabinet closed and she joined him in the living room.
"Calm down, Murdoch. You're not in trouble."
"I'm calm." She dipped her head toward the floor.
"You're doing the thing where you flex your toes, and I don't think you've blinked yet. Old habits die hard, right?"
"Not all of them."
"Good to hear."
She waved him to the big table in the dining room. It stood alone in the white room without the usual cluster of chairs he'd expect to see surrounding it. At least three or four maps covered the table. The largest one near the bottom covered almost two-thirds of the surface. It showed an island shaped like an old 50s flying saucer. The name was small and upside down, and Murdoch had never been good at reading upside down words. It took him a few moments to read the name and reorient the map in his mind. Anne cleared her throat.
"I wanted to check a last few things with you. Make sure everything was good."
Okay.
"Is there already a problem?"
No, he said. "Everything's going fine. I'm just..." "Don't you have elders or deacons to help you with this?" She nodded.
"I do, but I'm still getting to know them, and I know you. You've always been good at reading people and picking up on things. The Todwings are a small enough congregation that you would have heard about anything not going as planned."
Murdoch shrugged.
"If it makes you feel better, I could have you appointed as a deacon."
"Please don't." She laughed.
"Is the flight set up?"
He nodded. "Private jet flying out of Van Nuys tonight at 11:14. Should just get you to Paris, then Paris to Cairo, and from Cairo to..." He waved at the map.
"Visas?"
"I think Ambrose is working on it with a branch of the family based out of Cairo. Haven't heard of any hang-ups. Just..."
"Just what?"
Murdoch hooked his thumbs on his jeans.
"I know a couple people are worried this is draining all the congregation's money. They're not upset, just a little worried."
"They've had other ministers make false promises to them in the past," Anne said, squaring her shoulders. "I understand their concern, but once we do this, there won't be any need for money."
"I think they'd still prefer it if we were all flying coach."
Another laugh from Anne, shorter this time.
"Well, it's not like we can take our specialist on a Virgin Airways flight, is it?"
Murdoch pictured it in his mind, shrugged.
"Not really, no."
Speaking of which, did they send a car to pick her up?
He tapped his tongue against the roof of his mouth, trying to phrase his question carefully.
Does she have a name?
Not one you'd be able to pronounce. The car?
It left about an hour ago, he said, mentally brushing his questions aside. They haven't checked in, last I heard, but they've probably picked her up by now.
I hope so. Stretch limo, yes?
Yeah.
Good. More room for her to flail around, if that's her thing. What about the boat?
Mid-size yacht. It'll be waiting for us in Tuamasina when we arrive on Wednesday.
He paused.
So it's in Madagascar?
Anne nodded.
Near there, relatively speaking.
Murdoch stared at the map. He curled his lower lip in, squeezed it between his teeth, let it back out again.
Yes?
He blinked.
Nothing.
Seriously, I know all your tells. You haven't changed at all.
He cleared his throat.
If I may ask, how'd you find it? The family's been looking for over a century and you found it in just a few months.
108 days. Could have been less if we didn't have to move so slow.
So how'd you do it?
If you'll pardon a little bit of heresy,
she said, giving him a wink.
It's because most of the family elders are idiots.
Murdoch swallowed his immediate reaction. It caught in his throat and some of it bubbled out as an awkward cough. He covered it with a wry smile.
It's okay, she said. I won't tell the minister.
Thanks.
He tried to keep his expression neutral. If this was bait, he wasn't going to take it. She folded back two layers of maps to reveal a schoolroom-sized picture of the world. She gestured at the Eastern Hemisphere.
We've always had a vague idea where it should be, but they were so stuck in the past. They'd check the old books and cast their scrying bones. The smarter ones tried to make calculations, but even they were centuries out of date.
Anne pointed through a wide archway separating the apartment's dining area from the living room. A wooden steamer trunk sat against the wall, its latches hanging open.
Do you know what I found in Father Jacob's effects? An abacus and an astrolabe.
She shook her head.
The man had access to Google Earth and he was relying on navigation equipment people stopped using after the Middle Ages.
Murdoch bit his lip again.
Is that safe for us?
Us?
He blinked twice.
Sorry, not us, you and me. I mean for us, the family. After what happened with the Olmsteads, I thought one of the rules was to keep as low a profile as possible, even online. And since you worked for the government, sort of.
She nodded and let the maps fall back into place.
I know I'm on at least one or two of the more benevolent watch lists after my time with DARPA. It's bad for any of us to get online for much more than Twitter or Instagram, but anything I do falls right in a spotlight.
She picked up an old smartphone that had been holding down one corner of the maps.
Burner phone, she said. Just like in all the movies. They're anonymous, which means you turn the hotspot on and you've got anonymous internet. I told a few members of the congregation what to look for, and they'd spend a few hours a week browsing different search engines.
And you're sure that's safe?
We've bought dozens of them over the past 2 months. We swap them out every 2 or 3 days, just to be safe. I've got 2 kids who drive up and down the coast tossing the old ones in whatever rest stop or food court trash can they can find. Never the same one twice.
Smart.
These days it's just common knowledge,
said Anne. She set the phone back down on the maps.
Like I said, the elders have been centuries out of date. All it took was one change.
He nodded, looked at the image of Madagascar again.
What else do you need?
I think we've covered everything.
That's it?
She nodded once, lifted her chin a little higher.
Yes, that's everything. Thank you for coming.
Yeah. Sure.
They looked at each other for a few moments. Then, as the awkwardness began to pile up, he bowed his head and headed back to the front door. As he crouched, getting one shoe tied back on his foot, she cleared her throat.
Look,
she said.
Can we
talk?
Haven't we been talking?
You know what I mean.
She took an awkward step toward him, two quick steps back, and then settled almost exactly where she'd started out.
This is weird, right? Me and you, together again, with a new congregation, no less.
Murdoch kept his face blank and finished tying his other shoe. He didn't sense a trap, but he still had trouble reading her. And it had been so many years since he'd been honest with any member of the family. I'm not sure what you're talking about. She rolled her eyes.
I'm talking about the fact that we've seen each other naked more times than either of us can count, from about every angle possible. And now we're just standing here like we're two people in a supermarket line who vaguely recognize each other.
He straightened back up. Is this why you had me come here?
No. Maybe.
He relaxed, just a little. It's a bit weird.
Thank you,
she let out a little laugh.
I know it shouldn't be. We're supposed to be mature adults and everything.
But you're a minister now. It's going to be weird.
Yeah, I know.
She reached out, threaded her fingers through his, and squeezed once, a good, firm squeeze. Then she released his hand and stepped back.
I've got to be honest. I'm nervous about this.
This?
This,
she repeated, waving her hand back toward the dining room and all of her maps.
We're going to do it after more than a century, almost five generations. All those stories and predictions, and in the end, they were all about us.
I guess we'll see.
No, she said. This is it.
He almost spoke, but stopped his tongue.
I'm glad you're here with me, said Anne. I can't think of anyone else I'd want by my side for all of this.
Even with all the worry that had been spinning in his gut for years, he relaxed a little more. I'm glad to be here.
Just do me a favor.
She gave him an awkward, slightly mischievous smile.
If anyone asks how we know each other, be a little discreet.
He bowed his head. I promise only to talk about what a rocking body you had when we were younger, but not any of the things you did with it.
Remember,
she said,
I can actually have you killed.
He smirked.
And for the record, I still have a rocking body.
Going to waste now.
Play your cards right, maybe we can find some kind of loophole.
Murdoch shook his head and let out a laughing sigh. She pointed at the door.
Go, get ready. We have a flight to catch later.
4. At the start of each day, before showering, breakfast, or even coffee, Chase liked to go to the highest point on the ship he could and take in the view. Rain or shine, stormy or calm, he liked to start the day with the sea. He'd read a Stephen King book years back, one of the prison ones, and the phrase that had stuck with him was that the Pacific has no memory. Chase had found it to be blissfully true of at least three oceans so far. He stood on the walkway outside the bridge and leaned against the railing. From here, high up on the side of the Makara, he could swing his head in either direction. He could see the faraway prow and feel the wind on his face, or he could look almost down at the stern and feel the air pick and grasp at the back of his head. And out past the stern, a few miles behind them, was the monster storm. The past year at sea had told him that from this high up, the horizon was about 12 or 13 miles away, and he guesstimated the storm was a little closer than that, maybe 9 or 10 miles behind them, a sprawl of gray clouds 40 or 50 miles across. From this distance, they looked like a haze above the water, just thick enough to block some of the horizon from view. He couldn't see any movement with his eyes, but he'd heard one of the deckhands, a bruiser named Seth, say the storm was gaining on them. As he watched, a thread of white blinked into existence for a fraction of a second, connecting the clouds and the sea. He pictured having Dina with him,
counting off the seconds together as they waited for the thunder, a good old father-daughter activity. Of course, with the rumble of the engines and the rush of the wind, he'd never hear the thunder. And he'd never see Dina again, either. He focused on the storm. Dark threads reached down from the clouds, seemed to brush the surface of the ocean, and then withdrew. He watched the waterspouts curl and twist. He counted two stretching down, then three, and at one point there were at least 10. They didn't seem to have enough force or speed to stay connected for any length of time before retreating back into the clouds. Or maybe some other meteorological factor was at play that he just didn't understand. Five of Chase's previous trips had been smooth sailing. The big ships pushed through the water, their massive weight crushing the smaller waves flat beneath them. For the first few days, the rumble of the huge engines deep below had kept him awake. Now, he almost couldn't sleep without it. More than a few times, reading in his stateroom at night, he'd forgotten he was even at sea. His natural, half-sprawled sleeping position kept him stable on his bed throughout the night. Of the other two times, one had been rough enough to notice. He'd become aware of how weak his sea legs were. The other time? Well, the other time made him aware of how weak his sea stomach was. The lurching ship had thrown his belongings to the floor and thrown his lunch, a great chicken cordon bleu sandwich that hadn't tasted as great the second time, into the bathroom sink. It had taken almost an hour for the ship to get to clearer water. Chase had spent most of it braced in the bathroom doorway, even though he'd emptied his stomach. Katanga had called the storm behind them a monster. Chase didn't know a lot about weather, but his gut told him the first mate had been underestimating the storm. It wasn't just a monster. It was king of the monsters, a Godzilla of storms. In Chase's limited experience, there were only two responses to a storm. Ships could force their way through smaller ones and deal with the resulting chicken cordon bleu in the sink, or they could alter their course and swing out of the way, usually off the instructions from some central hub in Europe or Southeast Asia. As best he could tell, the Makara didn't have a main office anywhere. A few decades ago, it probably would have been called a tramp freighter, more or less independent, picking up all the smaller jobs the big companies priced themselves out of. He'd never been on a ship where the crew was eager to talk about their cargo, but on the Makara, they actively discouraged any discussion about the hundreds of containers stacked on deck. Chase assumed most of them were legal, but at least a few were enjoying the ship's lower profile when it slid into different ports around the world, which led him to believe the ship's course and schedule had less to do with a central office and perhaps more to do with a small handful of well-paying clients. Which was why, he guessed, Captain Hagen had ignored the two standard responses to a storm and chosen a third, ordering the Makara to full speed an hour before sunrise. He wanted to outrun the storm as long as possible before going off course to avoid it. If Chase understood the little snippets he'd overheard here and there over the past 2 weeks, the captain was hoping for a sweet bonus if he got his cargo to port early, or some specific part of his cargo. So far, the gamble seemed to be paying off. They were staying far ahead of the storm's edge, rushing toward the setting sun. The 11-year-old ship slammed against wave after wave, shoving them out of the way like a large man moving through a crowd. As if on cue, some muffled shouts slipped out from the bridge and were snatched away by the ocean winds and light spray. A steel hatch squealed open, then clanged shut.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph,"
snapped Ayman, the Tanzanian third mate.
"Didn't see you there. Sorry.
Seth told me to get off the deck, so I came up." Ayman cut him off with a swipe of a hand. A hand with three or four good-sized burn scars on it.
"Go grab breakfast or something," Captain's in a mood, and you'll get an hour of it if he runs into you like I just did.
Chase glanced back at the storm.
Is there a problem?
Look, for ballast, you seem like a good man, but get below decks.
Another wave crashed into the side of the ship, sending a cloud of spray racing between the stacked cargo pods below. Iman's face twisted into a scowl. The ship lurched against another swell, and they both rocked forward. It took Chase a few moments more to recognize the sensation. The Makara wasn't pushing through the waves anymore. They were pushing back, slowing her down, dragging her to a halt. Iman spat out something in Swahili. Chase couldn't understand the language, but he'd heard it plenty of times over the past 13 months. Whatever the word meant, Iman repeated it two more times, then added,
"The engines have stopped."
What?
Even as he said it, though, Chase felt it. The lurch of deceleration had hidden it, but now he sensed the lack of vibration in the walkway and the railing. The constant rumble of the Makara's huge engines had ceased. Another blast of shouting came from the bridge. Hagen sounded angry and frustrated all at once. Chase was starting to doubt that bonus was still in Hagen's future. He followed Iman's advice and headed back to the crew and passenger areas, although he made as much of the walk as he could outside. He quick-stepped down two of the steep, narrow staircases and cut across the deck. Then a hatch swung closed behind him, and the sounds of wind and water vanished. The Makara showed its age most with its interior carpeting. All the paint on the ship was fresh. Every surface was clean. But the carpets in the living areas showed their years of use. They were a rich, velvety blue near the bulkheads, fading to a weathered, beaten-down gray-blue near the center. He passed the galley. Two of the crew sipped coffee in their bright yellow coveralls, while a third shoveled the last of breakfast into his mouth. Continuing down the passageway took him past the unoccupied exercise room and the lounge. It had a large television, a trio of well-worn couches, two big chairs, and a fairly large, only slightly out-of-date collection of HD DVDs. And one occupant. Chase had tried hard to like Doug, the other civilian passenger on board the Makara, but something about the other man had rubbed him the wrong way right from the start. Not something, almost everything. It was as if some secret government lab had designed Doug to be as passively annoying as possible. He had bad taste in music, a wardrobe that felt put together from catalog pictures, and an opinion on everything. It was kind of amazing, really, how often he had an opinion, even on topics he knew nothing about. Doug's orange-brown beard stretched down to touch his chest. It ended in a carefully shaped wedge. The beard tried so hard to look like a rugged, natural growth on his chin and cheeks, but every inch of it proclaimed how thoughtfully it was maintained. Too neat, too straight, too well-shaped. He sprawled across one of the lounge couches, showing off today's outfit. A plaid vest Chase felt pretty sure was worn just to clash with the pink Oxford underneath it, a pair of bright red chucks at the end of jeans so tight the average supermodel would probably be too embarrassed to wear them. Doug's tablet balanced on his hand. Most internet devices were useless on a ship, but as he'd explained numerous times in the first week, he'd paid an outrageous amount to get a satellite phone that kept him connected. He needed it to upload video files to the cloud. His video files in the cloud came up a lot, too. It bothered Chase how much he knew about Doug. Almost none of it by choice. Still, they were going to be stuck together for another 6 days. Chase had made it this far. He didn't need a week of hostility with the only other civilian on the ship. He cleared his throat.
Morning.
Doug looked up from the tablet.
Hey, good morning, neighbor. You sleep good?
Yeah,
You have breakfast yet?
Yep.
His eyes drifted back to the tablet.
You?
I was going to hit the shower first.
All right. Did your morning meditation thing.
It's not meditation, just quiet time.
Right.
Onyango made these fantastic breakfast burritos. I ate three of them.
Okay. An excited tinny voice came from the tablet. Doug's brows wiggled up and down as he studied the screen. The corner of his mouth twisted up. Chase debated, weighed possible outcomes, and finally asked,
"What are you watching?"
"Well," Doug said, punctuating it with a long, suffering sigh,
"it's supposed to be the KTLA evening news stream from LA, but it looks like some hacker hijacked it and replaced it with a giant monster movie."
"Godzilla?"
"I wish. Who doesn't love a good monster suit, right? No, it's some found footage thing. Can't figure out if it's any good or not."
"Why not?" Chase kicked himself for asking, but the words had slipped out before he could stop them.
"Well," Doug said again, "the director's too in love with all his monster stuff. We keep getting all these helicopter shots of it, views from the street, graphics of where it is in the city. It looks great, but there are no characters. I mean, who am I supposed to be rooting for in this, right? Where's the hero's journey? The redemptive arc, all the stuff that makes a story worthwhile. Right?"
"Yeah, I guess it."
"And it's kind of dull, to be honest. I mean, nobody likes explosions when they hit Michael Bay levels and everything blows up, but you want something to blow up. Right?"
Chase shrugged in response.
"Plus, this whole found footage thing is so 2008. Right? Nobody with any talent does this crap anymore. Cloverfield did it better. And even it wasn't that great."
He flipped the screen around to show a dark-haired woman on a nighttime street.
"That's a nice touch, though. They got what's-her-name, the real evening news person, to do a spot. Nobody outside of L.A. will get it, but it's cute."
"Is that normal? Getting a newscaster to do fake news stuff?"
Doug turned the screen back to himself and his eyes drifted back down. "For movies? Oh, yeah. Everyone in Los Angeles wants to be in the industry. I remember one of our newscasters showed up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. once, just playing herself, reporting on superheroes and stuff."
Chase waited for something more, but Doug had slipped back into the movie. He decided to count his blessings. He took a step back into the passageway and continued down to his stateroom. He got out of the shower 15 minutes later to the phone ringing. It wasn't really a phone, more of a shipboard intercom with delusions of grandeur, but it hadn't rung before, and he found himself jumping to answer it, almost dropping his towel as he dashed across the room.
"Hello?
Chesa.
Katanga?
I am sorry if I woke you."
"No, I've been up. I just got out of the shower."
"Then get dressed. Captain Hagen would like you to join him for breakfast."
"What?"
"Breakfast. Half an hour from now in the galley."
"Is this about the engines?"
"Just be dressed and in the galley in half an hour."
"Okay."
"And Chesa."
"Yes?"
Katanga's voice dropped, and Chase pictured the man cupping his hand around the mouthpiece on his end.
"Don't worry. It's all going to be fine."
"What is?"
"Half an hour in the galley."
The line went dead. 5. Chase walked into the galley and saw Captain Hagen sitting in the back at his table. Their eyes met, and Hagen gestured toward the trays of food with his fork. Then the captain turned his attention back to his plate, spearing a sausage patty and popping it whole into his mouth. At the buffet, Iman filled his own plate, a few strips of bacon, a prepackaged Danish, and what looked like a foil-wrapped breakfast burrito. He gave Chase a polite nod of the head, but kept his mouth shut. He balanced his plate on one hand, filled a coffee cup, and went to sit two tables over from Hagen. There was, Chase noticed, nobody else in the galley.
Not even Max, the steward who normally refilled the chafing dishes and cleaned up the counters. Just him, Hagen, and Iman. He went along the line, picked up a few things, and then stood by the coffee pot. Hagen looked up, waved him over.
"Please,"
he said, gesturing at the seat across from him. Hagen was a tall Scandinavian with a faintly drooping face, a bird's nest of curling gray-blonde hair, and beautifully accented English that made Chase feel a bit ashamed talking to him sometimes. The man always wore a dark, snug Henley beneath a pair of wide suspenders. He either washed the shirt nightly or owned a dozen near-identical ones. Twice Chase had seen him wear the sleeves pushed up to show off a swirl of elaborate tattoos on hard, muscled arms. Over the past 2 weeks, they'd had dinner twice and talked once during a casual tour of the Makara's Bridge. Hagen's attitude toward extra passengers fell somewhere between indifference and begrudging acceptance. His conversations with Chase had been limited to different ports they'd each visited and the small, overlapping collection of books they'd both read. That was all. Chase set his plate down.
"Good morning."
Hagen stopped eating and dabbed at his mouth with a napkin.
"Good morning. Thank you for joining me at the last minute." "It's no problem. I was heading here anyway. Is something happening?" "It can wait until after we eat."
A few minutes later, Doug wandered into the galley, the backpack with his tablet and other recording gear slung over his shoulder. He waved to Chase, grabbed a plate, and began scooping scrambled eggs and sausages onto it. A few minutes later, it clattered down next to Chase.
"Morning, campers," he said.
He walked back, got himself a cup of coffee, and joined them at the table.
"I thought you already ate,"
Chase said. Doug raised his cup to Hagen.
"Breakfast with the captain. I didn't want to look ungrateful."
Hagen replied with a thin smile that he covered with his coffee mug. They ate for a few minutes without another word. Chase munched on a slice of toast. Doug continued to smile at the other man while he shoved food in his mouth. Hagen took the last corner of his own toast and ran it around his plate, soaking up bits of egg, sausage grease, and butter. He washed it down with some coffee and dabbed at his mouth with the napkin again.
"So,"
he said, pushing the plate to the side.
"You may have noticed we're having some engine trouble."
Chase nodded.
"We are?"
asked Doug.
"Is it bad?"
Hagen sipped his coffee.
"Bad is relative. If we were in port, it wouldn't be bad. If these were calm seas, it wouldn't be a problem. If we weren't on a tight schedule, you get the idea."
"So it's bad,"
said Chase.
"It's not ideal,"
Hagen agreed.
"It's made worse by radio interference."
"How much interference are we talking about?"
"We haven't been able to make contact with any port."
"So we don't have engines or communications?"
Chase set his fork down.
"That's definitely bad."
"If you like," said Doug, picking his pack up from the floor.
"You're welcome to use my satellite phone. It should be able to..."
Hagen held up a hand.
"We have a satellite phone. Calls have been made to certain parties."
"I can take a look at the radio if you like," Chase said. "Electronics are kind of my thing."
"The insurance companies would never hear of it, but thank you for the offer."
Hagen paused for another sip of coffee.
"As it happens," he continued, "insurance is what I wished to speak to you about. We need to take certain precautions because of the oncoming storm regarding the two of you."
Chase felt a twinge of uncertainty between his eyes. Doug paused in his eating.
"What's that mean?"
he asked through a mouthful of scrambled eggs.
"The storm is a few hours out. With no engines, Makara is in for an especially rough time. There are also certain items of cargo which are going to require complete attention to make sure they stay safe. It will be better in several regards if neither of you was on board for this."
"Sorry, what?" Hagen smiled. Chase thought it felt like a banker's smile, a little too practiced, not entirely honest.
If anything happened to the two of you, the captain explained, even just a minor injury, it would bring a great deal of attention to us and this trip and perhaps some of the cargo.
The cargo? Echoed Doug. The smile got a little wider.
We are all men of the world here, yes? We understand how things work. Some of Makara's clients prefer less visibility. Nothing illegal, but they'd be unhappy with the attention an insurance investigation might bring.
Chase cleared his throat.
Are we talking about...
Hagen's hand came back up.
We are not talking about anything. First rule, we do not discuss the cargo. I'm simply trying to explain the situation we all find ourselves in.
Doug ate more scrambled eggs.
So, we're being evacuated? Asked Chase.
In a manner of speaking. No, sorry, calm yourself. I phrased that poorly.
They all shared an uneasy laugh.
There's a small island about 3 miles away. A few of the crew will take you over there and wait out the storm with you. Afterwards, you can all come back. Perhaps we'll even have the engine repaired by then. But from what my engineer tells me, that's not likely.
I'd be fine staying on the ship, said Doug. He hefted his bag. I could get footage of the storm, all of you working. It'd be cool.
And again, that won't be possible for insurance purposes. Just consider this a little adventure.
Sounds like the setup for a bad horror movie,
Doug grumbled, shoving a piece of toast into his mouth.
And when the storm's passed, Chase said, we come back to the ship, right?
Yes, Hagen assured him. We are not stranding you there like a pair of Robinson Crusoes. That would cause far more insurance problems.
Good to know.
The captain set both hands on his mug in a thoughtful way.
I apologize for this, truly. There is a chance you may have an uncomfortable night on the island, too, at the absolute most. But rest assured, you'll probably be better off than the rest of us. I almost envy you.
Chase tried to think of something to say or a question to ask. Doug swallowed loudly and pushed his own plate away.
What's its name?
Hagen blinked twice.
I beg your pardon?
The island, what's its name?
To be honest, I have no idea. It's not on any of our charts or maps. I believe it's too far from any mainland for anyone to claim it.
So it's our island, Doug said with a smile.
If you like. Is that normal?
Asked Chase.
I mean, an uncharted island in the middle of nowhere?
More common than many people realize, Hagen said. Once you travel out of the shipping lanes, there's a great deal of ocean no one ever sees. We never would have seen it ourselves if we hadn't gone slightly off course trying to stay ahead of the storm.
But we're sure it's safe.
Hagen lifted his cup, looked into it, and set it back down with a small sigh.
It looks to be barely 3 or 4 square miles. The closest major land mass is Madagascar, almost 1,000 miles away. There will be no angry natives, no big predators, no lions or tigers or crocodiles.
He gave his cool smile again.
Perhaps a dinosaur or two.
Doug laughed.
My man will be in charge. Please give him all the courtesy you give me. You'll be departing in...
Hagen glanced at his watch as he stood up.
45 minutes.
Doug stopped laughing.
What?
Well, we can't send you out after the storm hits.
Chase stood up as well.
How are we getting there?
Lifeboat?
Hagen shook his head.
No, lifeboats are for a very specific use. They have emergency beacons and lights, and they're expensive to reload. Again, insurance. We'll be using a Zodiac.
You've got a Zodiac?
Yes.
Why?
Hagen gave him a patient stare.
Just in case we need to run to shore for something.
A figure moved on the edge of Chase's vision. Iman had finished eating and moved one table closer. He sat just behind Doug, sipping a hot cup of tea. Hagen clapped his hands together.
Well then, I need to go speak with my engineer, and you need to go pack for a day or two. Thank you for being so understanding and cooperative. I'll see you back here as soon as the storm breaks.
He gave them each a sharp bow of his head, acknowledged Iman, and headed out.
You had the captain, Iman said. 45 minutes, and that was 5 minutes ago.
6. This close, the island sprawled along the horizon, filling most of Chase's vision when water wasn't spraying in his face. He guessed it was maybe a little under a mile wide. Palm trees towered across it, swaying back and forth in the wind. Iman angled the motor and the Zodiac bounced over a last few waves before gliding up onto the eastern beach. The other crewman with them, Seth, had already flipped his legs over the rounded frame of the boat and let momentum toss him up onto his feet. He dragged a line with him and hauled it 5, 10, 15 feet up onto the beach, pulling the Zodiac another foot or two out of the water as he did. Doug lurched forward, but did a halfway decent job of making it look like he'd wanted to brace himself on the inflatable boat's swollen tubes. His other hand pawed at the strap of his bag as it slipped down across his shoulder. He pushed himself up and staggered out onto the sand. Seth came back, waved Chase to the side, and pulled a steel rod the length of his arm from the floor of the boat, one end hooked over like an old man's cane. Seth even swung it like one as he hiked back up the beach. Chase didn't know much about Seth. The wiry Somalian didn't talk much and seemed no-nonsense. The only thing Chase had learned about him was the man didn't ever take off his beanie, a black ribbed cap topped with a ragged black and white pom-pom. He wore it out on deck with his jumpsuit, in the galley, in the lounge. Maybe he slept in it too. Behind them, Iman locked the motor in position, then popped open the case and plucked something out.
Fuse, he explained, seeing Chase's look. Motor won't start without it, so no one can steal the boat.
Chase looked up the beach to the tree line.
Do you think there are a lot of boat thieves here?
Better safe than sorry. That's what they say, right?
He tucked it into the pocket of his jeans.
I guess so. As long as you don't lose the fuse.
Iman waved a dismissive hand and pulled a close-to-bursting backpack from under his bench. A series of sharp clangs echoed across the beach as Seth used a rock to pound the steel cane deep into the sand. Each impact made his pom-pom bounce back and forth. Despite the warmth, he'd decided to wear a heavy cotton sweater to the island. Chase swung a leg out of the raft and stepped onto dry land. The white, clean sand reminded him of beaches in Houston where he'd taken Dina, where he'd gone as a kid himself. Almost no rocks, a minimal amount of seaweed at the high water mark just below where Seth worked. The tree line began about 10 yards from the water. The palm trees stretched a good 30 or 40 feet into the air, but Chase felt pretty sure he could get his arms almost halfway around the trunks. A scattering of tall, weedy grass stretched back into the forest. Not the worst place to spend a day or two. Doug had pulled on a beanie, too, with a large triangle fringe circling it like a crown. He opened his bag and pulled out the little pole he referred to as his handheld camera setup. It didn't seem to be anything more than a handle with a clip to hold his cell phone. He insisted on using it for almost everything. The clangs stopped. Seth had hammered more than two-thirds of the metal cane into the sand. He scooped up the line from the raft, made a few loops, and deftly tied off the boat. A new sound echoed across the beach, metal sliding against metal, ending with a snap. Doug looked up from his equipment, and his eyes went wide.
"What's the hardware for?"
He punctuated the question with a nervous laugh. Chase looked to his left in time to see Iman take his hand off the pistol's slide. He slid it into a nylon holster that appeared on his hip
The captain insisted, he explained. We have no idea who or what is on this island.
He hiked up the side of his hockey shirt, making sure it stayed tucked around the holster.
You're really serious about not letting anyone steal the boat, said Chase.
Iman grinned and pulled another holstered semi-automatic pistol from his pack. He barked out something in Swahili to Seth as the other man ambled back to the Zodiac and tossed the gun to him with a gentle, underhand throw. Seth caught it and slipped the paddle holster onto the waistband of his corduroys.
Did you bring enough for the whole class?
Doug asked with a chuckle. Seth and Iman both looked at him.
No, said Seth.
Chase glanced at Iman's hip. He didn't recognize the pistol, but it was mostly hidden by the holster, and there were only a handful of pistols he could recognize on sight anyway.
Better safe than sorry?
Iman grinned again.
Yes, indeed.
He headed up the beach with the pack slung over one shoulder. Doug had his phone up on the stick. He turned in a slow circle, panning the lens across the water, the raft, the beach.
Why do you have guns on the ship anyway? Aren't there international laws about that sort of thing?
We have them in case of pirates, said Seth.
He took a few steps to his left, keeping away from the lens.
And the occasional passenger we want to get rid of.
Doug laughed, then let it die when he realized Seth was staring at him. He turned his attention back to his camera work and muttered a few words Chase couldn't make out. Seth reached back to get another bag from the raft, and Chase wandered farther up the beach. More of a hike, really. The stretch of sand had a noticeable slope toward the water. He pushed his feet down into the sand and took a few big strides toward the trees.
Oh, come on, said Doug. He turned almost completely around. Right into my shot.
Sorry.
Chase took a few more strides, angling himself away, and headed toward Iman. The man had stopped a few yards past the steel anchor point, staring at the trees. Chase tried to follow his gaze.
What's up?
The lanky man held up two fingers, shushing him. Chase waited to see something move. He strained to hear a telltale sound. After 20 or 30 seconds, he picked out a big beetle or something crawling down a tree trunk a few yards away, but nothing else.
There is someone watching us,
murmured Iman. Chase felt his eyes widen. He searched the trunks of the trees.
Where?
Iman lifted his hand, set it down on the butt of his pistol.
Do you see the bush with the red flowers? He is in the shadows to the right of it.
Are you sure?
Chase asked, keeping his voice low.
Yes, I saw him move, saw the light hit his eyes.
I don't see anything.
He is there, and he is holding something up by his head.
I still don't see anything.
I am looking directly at him.
Chase studied the shadows, tried to pick out something that looked less like a tree and more like a person. He found at least half a dozen possible shapes, but as he stared, two of them turned out to be fallen palm fronds and the rest were just illusions created by broken light and perspective. Iman slid his pistol out.
Whoa, Chase said. Are you sure about this?
I see you,
Iman said to the trees, raising his voice just above a normal speaking level. He aimed the pistol into the trees.
Drop your weapon and step out onto the beach.
Nothing happened. He spoke again in Swahili, a few quick bursts of words. When that didn't get a reaction, he switched to French, although the words came much slower this time. Chase remembered enough of his high school French to confirm the man was repeating the same order he'd given in English. Still, nothing from the forest. Chase let out a little breath.
I think it might just be a trick of the light. I don't think there's anyone.
He is right there,
snapped Iman. His pistol didn't waver.
He is wearing a hood and some sort of camouflaged cloak that blends with the trees.
Hey, yelled Doug. What are you guys looking at? Chase waved a hand at Doug, gesturing down at the sand. Did you see something cool?
Aye, man,
called out Seth. He followed it up with some more Swahili as he headed up the beach to join them. Iman answered in the same language, then tilted his head back toward the forest.
You in the trees, he shouted. I am giving you one last chance. Lower your weapon, or I will defend us.
As he spoke, he adjusted his aim. Okay, said Chase. Maybe you should just calm down.
Whoa, shouted Doug. You can't just kill someone.
Yes, I can, Iman said.
No, said Doug. No, you can't. They might be indigenous people.